Amen. Zechariah chapter 9 is where we are. And I just entitled this message, God's Sovereignty Over Nations and History. And we'll be using the overhead in just a few minutes to show you a picture of some maps of Alexander the Great's conquest of the Palestine area. And it's really not well known in history. If you were to take a world history class or something, Alexander the Great's conquest of Palestine would probably be little more than a footnote. It might just be mentioned, and it only might be mentioned because of the interest that some have had in the city of Tyre that we'll talk about in just a few moments. But let's read together the first seven verses of this particular passage, first eight verses. The burden of the word of the Lord against the land of Hadrach and Damascus, its resting place. For the eyes of men and all the tribes of Israel are on the Lord. Also against Hamath, which borders on it, and against Tyre and Sidon, though they are very wise. For Tyre built herself a tower, heaped up silver like the dust, and gold like the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out. He'll destroy her power in the sea, and she'll be devoured by fire. Ashkelon shall see it in fear. Gaza also shall be very sorrowful, and Ekron, for he dried up her expectation. The king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. A mixed race shall settle in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. I will take away the blood from his mouth and the abominations from between his teeth. But he who remains, even he shall be for our God, and shall be like a leader in Judah, and Ekron like a Jebusite. I will camp around my house because of the army, because of him who passes by and him who returns. No more shall an oppressor pass through them, for now I've seen with my eyes. Often when you're reading through the Old Testament, especially the prophetic sections, it's sections like this that in all honesty, make it hard to read. Because as you read that, you're trying to figure out, what is he saying? What's God saying? What's being said here? What's he talking about, and what am I supposed to learn from it? Well, if there's anything we accomplished through the book of Zechariah, I hope that you're learning how to interpret the book, and I hope that you're also learning some things so the next time you read the book of Zechariah, you'll understand it a whole lot better because it's rich and it's full. It's like a gold mine here. The first thing we see in verse number one is that he's the Lord of all the earth. You notice it says the bottom part of it, well, against the land of Hadrach. No one knows for sure exactly where that is. It's probably considered like a county region. And Damascus in the middle of that. It's probably what it's talking about. And then it says, for the eyes of men and all the tribes of Israel are on the Lord. And this really goes well with verse number 8, where it talks about the eyes of the Lord and says, this is the Lord talking. For now I've seen with my eyes. I will camp around my house because of the army, because of him who passes by and him who returns. No more shall an oppressor pass through them. For now I have seen with my eyes, and that's the Lord talking. So we see the eyes of men are on the Lord. Then we see the eyes of the Lord are especially on his house or upon Israel. And really what we can learn from that is we can learn the aspect that he's the Lord of heaven and earth. And men know God. We're told this in the book of Romans. There's natural revelation. They know that there is a God. They may not know who this God is, but they know that God exists. They know that he's true. There are really no atheistic cultures. Cultures become atheistic, but cultures are traditionally religious. And they will make idols. They'll make false gods. They'll worship false things. But they will know that there's a God. Our own secular society is really a religious society, if you think about it, because with their creation account being evolution and their dynamic of how providence works out being chance and the destiny is controlled by man. All these are very religious concepts. So even secular humanism is a religion of sorts as it plays itself out. And men are naturally religious and they answer these questions in various ways. Now, the eyes of the world around the Lord, they can see his handiwork. They can see all the things he's made. They can know that there's a creator. They worship false gods. But the eyes of the Lord are on his people. That's the point. And there's the contrast there between verse 1 and verse number 8 of what's really important. And now we see that God's providence extends beyond Israel. It's not just, and that's the way the nations would have looked at it in the old days. In this Old Testament period, for instance, if you lived in Ascalon, then you would have your God that you worshipped, right? And then you'd be talking about Israel. You'd say, yeah, they have their God too. They got Jehovah. They worship Jehovah. But we have our God. He's here. He's Dagon. And so they would often go to war, and they would see it as the battle of the gods. Our God against your God. Boom. And then they'd fight to see whose God was stronger and whose God would help them. And, of course, we know from the Old Testament perspective that God often had his people lose those battles, not because he wasn't strong enough to win, but for their sake, for their cause, and with his eye and purpose, because his eye was on them. But here his eye turns now, as it often does in the Old Testament prophecies, to the nations. And the nations are mentioned here in verses 2 through 7, the upheaval of the nations. And let's just look at them, and then we're going to take a look at the overhead and get a bit of a picture of a map. Because there's some interesting prophecy that falls into here. Like I said, the land of Hadrach, that's probably the area around Damascus. Damascus is still in Syria, just like it was in that day, as you look into your scriptures there. Tyre and Sidon, famous cities. Even Christ talked about Sodom and Gomorrah and Tyre and Sidon when he talked about absolute dissolution and destruction. And so they became symbols of that. Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, Ashdod, these are all Philistine cities. There were five primary Philistine cities. Gath is the one that's not mentioned here. What famous Bible character comes from Gath? Goliath of Gath. That's what he's known as. Well, Gath may not even be around any longer at the time of Zechariah. No one knows for sure, but it could be that the city was already uninhabited, or it could be that it was such a lesser city by this time that the five Philistine cities had become four, basically. Or maybe they were still powerful and just aren't mentioned just because of whatever reason. Things are still being discovered. As I said in our prayer, archaeology, we should never be afraid of archaeology, because it's just like the true sciences. When they truly discover, when they truly find out, it's amazing that they find out, well, isn't that something? The Bible was right again, after all. And so we never really need to be afraid of that. We need to be afraid of science falsely so-called, because men come up with their own ideas. So just an interesting sidelight. If you go back about 150 years, there were historians that would deny that the Philistines even existed. They thought that it was just a made-up name. And then Christians would fight back saying, well, no, they really were there, but they were known by different names, and maybe they were these guys, and maybe they were these guys. And the same thing happened with the Hittites. There were no such thing as the Hittites. Well, and the Christians would try to get defensive and argue back, well, Philistines existed. They've been found. Their remains and the archaeological digs are there. The Hittites, the same thing. And so whenever you hear authoritative declarations like that, well, there's no such thing as, just wait. You don't get all upset. Don't get all angry. Don't get all defensive and try to come up with schemes explaining away the Bible. You don't have to do that. God's word is true. You can relax and rest in it. The prophecy we have here is an amazing prophecy. Look at verse 3. Verse 2, sorry. Tyre and Sidon, though they're very wise. Obviously, Tyre has the precedence over Sidon. They were somewhat sister cities, but Tyre became the predominant city for reasons we're going to mention in a second. For Tyre built herself a tower, heaped up silver like the dust and gold like the mire of the streets. It was a very wealthy city. It was an affluent city. It was a well-known city in its day. And they inhabited the area, and then they outgrew the area, and they moved out to an island about a half mile into the Mediterranean Sea. So Tyre was actually a sister city, Tyre and Tyre. And Tyre was on an island, and Tyre, of course, was still on the mainland. And we'll talk about that in just a few moments. But it was a very wealthy, affluent, powerful city. And notice what it says. Behold, the Lord will cast her out. He will destroy her power in the sea. She'll be devoured by fire. Now, she built a tower, and it's a well-known historical fact that on this island fortress that they built for themselves, the towers extended as high as 150 feet into the air. And Tyre was considered impregnable that no one could take it down. In fact, she proved herself to be impregnable in a number of battles. Shalmaneser of Assyria, he besieged the city for 5 years and couldn't conquer it and gave up. Nebuchadnezzar, he tried for 13 years and failed and could not capture the city. But during that time, the mainland city was deserted and they all moved to the island. And so it was no longer a mainland city because of the Nebuchadnezzar's siege. They're all living on the island then as a fortress city. And they had walls, like I said, towers 150 feet in the air. And this would have been during Zechariah's time that we're talking about, that would have taken place. And that's the way that Tyre would have been. It would have been known as that type of a city then. But around 333 B.C. was when we see this particular prophecy fulfilled. The Lord will cast you out, he'll destroy your power in the sea, shall be devoured by fire. Now, before we show that, just look at what that's going to do to these other weaker towns. And if Tyre can't stand, how's Ashkelon going to stand? Well, she's not. You know, if you can destroy Tyre, you can destroy Ashkelon, probably without a problem. Gaza, without much of a fight. Ekron, you know, their hearts will sink when they see the fortress destroyed. Then they know that they're sunk too. And sure enough, that's exactly what did happen. And let's just take a look at a couple of pictures here that I'll show you. If you have any questions, you can ask. Let me show you the campaign first of all. Like I said, Alexander the Great, we're going to look at him for a little bit today because he's mentioned in the Bible a few times. The Bible wasn't written during his time. He comes during the 400 silent years, but he's a very important biblical character, if we want to put it that way, in the aspect of prophecy. Let me just flip this off here. Just so you can see a little better. This is just a map here to show you the general idea. It's a little misleading because it's black and white, but this isn't the sea. This is a desert. Okay. And the sea is up here. That's where the sea is. So it's a little hard to see, but if you get your bearings that way. Okay, so what we have is we have Alexander the Great coming from the area of Greece over in here, marching on down, coming around. And even though this map doesn't show it here, he eventually makes his campaign that we're talking about down through here. Here's Tyre. There's Jerusalem real close to it. The Philistine cities are right in through here. Sidon would be up there. That's what we're talking about. Hamath is mentioned. It's up there, of course. And so really what you have, and this is the way the historians would look at it, they would basically see Palestine as a land bridge to Africa. That's where Alexander the Great really wants to go. But he is also a man that's always ready for a battle. And he sees Tyre. And Tyre is there and it's fortified. And if there's anything Alexander the Great likes, it's a fight. So he says, okay, here's our chance to have our really good fight with our really strong enemy. And he sets his sights to go against Tyre in one of the most remarkable battles that have ever been fought. In fact, here's a picture from, got this from a military site where it actually talks about great battles. And the siege of Tyre is here and how he accomplished it. And you can see, is that in focus? Okay. You can see, here's what we're talking about. There's the mainland that we just said, and here's the island that's about a half mile offshore. But it's really not real deep. It's relatively shallow. And so what he was able to do, he was able to take the rubble of the old city and build a land bridge out to them. Now, it becomes a little more complicated than that because Tyre was fighting back all the time. So he was fighting with catapults and throwing rocks and fire into the city. They were fighting back and destroying this land bridge as he went. But it was an amazing maneuver that he did. But in the meantime, while that battle was raging like that, his armies were also fighting other places. He took over a few navies. Alexander the Great didn't have a great navy at that particular time. But he took over a few navies that came to help him from up above and around. The word got out. They came down. The navies came down around this way. And while they're fighting here, the navies came up and attacked him there. And that's where they show that right there. You notice those are the... Here's the ships, and the ships come in here. The battle's raging here. Well, there they go. They're done for. So it really wasn't the land bridge itself that ended up defeating Tyre, but it was the distraction that they had to do, because the army, if they wouldn't have stopped them on the land bridge, they would have just marched across. And eventually they did. Once that happened, then they were able to bring the army across too, because there was no longer the what we might call the shelling going on. It wasn't shelling with artillery like we know, but, you know, the oil and all the stuff and the fire and all the things that they're throwing back and forth towards each other. And so that was a great battle, as you can see. And Alexander the Great, they estimate, had about 400 of his men killed in the battle. And, of course, 8,000 residents of Tyre were killed or executed. 30,000 civilians were enslaved. And the only reason it wasn't a higher number than that was the men of Tyre sent a lot of the women and children out of it up into some regions up in through here, by boats from the backside. But during the seven-month siege, it took 7 months for this to happen. And so that ended up being the battle as it was fought there. Just another slide here to show you. A little better picture of the area that we're talking about here, because here it shows you Tyre, and then you can see the Bible talking about Ascalon and Gaza. So there, this is the way, the land bridge down to Egypt, as we said. Notice that Jerusalem's right here. This is going to be very important. So note where Tyre is in relation to Jerusalem and how Alexander's army is coming down this way and how they head back the other way. Alexander's army never went to Jerusalem, notice. There's a reason for that. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But they never went there. Alexander the Great himself apparently went to Jerusalem, but not with his army. And we'll talk about why in a moment, as I said. Got one more map there. Let me jog my own memory and see why it's there. Oh, this just shows the campaigns in general. Because really, he wanted to go all the way into India, which he did do. You know, so you can see, this is almost, he went through it twice, this area that we're concerned with biblical prophecy and from the scriptures. But it's almost an afterthought to him, except for the Battle of Tyre, which he found very interesting and enjoyed very much. I'm sorry to say that he loved war. And so we have this sort of thing going on here, coming down, around, back up. And then where he really wanted to go, which was out into here, which he did, and then circled back around to Babylon. So there's the campaigns that you see that were taking place. And interestingly enough, Mike, would you mind turning that light back on there? Interestingly enough, the Bible speaks about that here. And, of course, it does so in prophetic language, so it's not always easiest to understand. But notice the destruction of Tyre is prophesied. People in Zechariah's day would have said, well, how is that going to happen? You know, Shalmaneser couldn't do it in 5 years. Nebuchadnezzar couldn't do it in 13 years. And you're going to tell us the city's going to be destroyed? Alexander the Great did it in 7 months. Boom. Just like the Lord basically said would happen. And not only that, but verse 8, I will camp around my house because of the army, because of him who passes by and him who returns. Obviously talking about Alexander the Great, as we just saw. That's what he did. Down and up. Just like it says here prophetically that he would do. No more shall an oppressor pass through them, for I have seen with my eyes, talking about the protection of the Lord. Now, Alexander the Great is an interesting character, if you just love history, but he's an important biblical character, because used of the Lord, because during the 400 silent years, where the Bible doesn't write any history at all, things were still happening, and God was still moving towards Messiah coming. Now, what basically happened in a nutshell is, the world was Hellenized to a great extent. Greek became a national language, understood by most everyone. And also the road system was built once the Greeks were overthrown. Then the roads were built, which made for easy traveling. And that made it very easy for the gospel to penetrate into all these regions. You noticed that they even went into India, you know, and even towards India, the gospel extended itself, we're to believe. So, well, all this takes place in God's providence, basically. And the Romans also brought the Pax Romana, which was basically a worldwide peace. It may have been done very cruelly, and it may have been done by domination, but it was peace nonetheless. So there weren't continual warfares that were always springing up. You had a situation where people could travel freely throughout the known world, basically, and you wouldn't be captured for being a spy for coming from a neighboring country or something like that, which happens from time to time. So it really sets the stage for the gospel to be. But it also is interesting. Turn to Daniel chapter 7. Now, I'll just tell you this. As we turn to Daniel chapter 7, we would see Alexander the Great in these prophecies here, too, of Daniel. Now, historically, we don't know for sure that this is what happened. But I'll just tell you what is considered by some to be a legend and others historical fact. And maybe one day there'll be corroborating evidence to show. But Josephus writes about the fact that Alexander the Great did not attack Jerusalem. Well, we know that's historically true. We know he didn't attack Jerusalem. And we see in Zechariah 9:8 that he wasn't going to attack Jerusalem. It was prophesied that he wouldn't. But Josephus gives us a little bit of history of why he didn't. Like I said, this is not the Bible, and this is not 100% fact. It's Josephus. Understand that. But Josephus claims that Jeduah the high priest had warned from God. He had a warning from God in which he saw himself vested in a purple robe and a mitre and a gold plate and the name of God engraved on his head. So Jeduah the high priest has this vision. And so he makes an outfit that's like that, that like he saw in the vision. Well, supposedly, according to Josephus, Alexander the Great had a vision of the same character dressed like that. So when the high priest comes out to meet him, Alexander the Great says, "There's the man I saw in my vision. There he is." You know, and everyone knew that Jehovah was the God of Israel, and he was the high priest of the God of Israel. So Alexander the Great took great delight in the fact that God was speaking to him. You know, because Alexander the Great no pretense to be a Christian or, a believer in Jehovah, in the Jewish sense of the word, but quite impressed by that. And then according to Josephus, Jeduah, the high priest, opened the book of Daniel to him and showed him where he was prophetically in the book of Daniel, which pleased Alexander the Great also. So he spared Jerusalem and wouldn't attack it. So, like I say, that is no corroborating evidence for that in anywhere else in history, except for the accounts of Josephus. We do know that it's true that he didn't attack Jerusalem. And it'd be interesting if there ever is any kind of writings that are discovered or something like that that would corroborate that particular story. But let me also say Josephus is a little bit given to exaggeration from time to time. So it could be a true story with a little bit of legend mixed in there to make it look a little bit better. A little bit of tabloid journalism, maybe. It's true. Look at Daniel 7, verse 6. These would be the verses that would have been shown to Alexander the Great and talk about him. "After this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it." Chapter 8, verses 5 through 8. "And I was considering, and suddenly a male goat came up from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns," Medes and Persians, "which had seen standing beside the river and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore, the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up towards the four winds of the heavens." And that is such an exacting description of historically what happened with Alexander the Great defeating the Medes and the Persians, and then his own empire being split into four parts. Unbelieving historians have often said this is no way written prior to the account. It has to be written after the account. It's too exact. You can't have prophecy that exact. That's ridiculous, of course. Chapter 8, verse 20. "The ram which you saw, having the two horns, they're the kings of Media and Persia. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, Four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And like I said, that's just exacting as you can be. And historically, absolutely accurate. That can be proven. Yes, Jeff?
I want to say, Veronica took a history class, and the author of the history book that she used tried to emphasize that Alexander's kingdom was put into three portions, not four. But if you look at the map, the Eastern kingdom didn't really last very long. Right. He didn't count that, but if you look at the map, it's still four.
Yeah, it's still four. Sorry. Yeah, it's true. One of them was very weak, and the second one was very weak, too. One was weaker than the others, and two become the primary ones. That's true. But it's also true there's four. And to deny that is just an attempt to, I guess, it'd be an attempt to prove the Bible wrong. I don't know what else you'd be trying to do by denying that. It was divided into four. Anyway, one more place, chapter 11, verses 3 and 4 of Daniel. That's another reason that prophecy is often hard to read, because it often skips around. As you can see, we've skipped around in Daniel. Then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these. And so there's another prophecy that would have been true of Alexander the Great there, found in the book of Daniel. So Tyre fell, just as Zechariah said. Back to Zechariah here. Back to Zechariah chapter 9. Tyre fell. The Philistines were so cut off effectively that we don't even have accounts of the warfare between Alexander and the Philistines. They probably just gave up. They probably just capitulated, and that's what nations would often, city-states would often do that. They didn't want to fight. They just give up and succumb, which is probably what they did, making an easy march down into Egypt. Verse 7 is an ugly picture of heathen sacrifice. Take away the blood from his mouth. Just think of, in our culture, some cultures will do this, but in our culture, drinking blood isn't considered a very appetizing or good thing. If you understand the Old Testament law of blood being an unclean thing, and that you're not to eat the blood, this is really a reprehensible and repulsive picture. And God destroys them while the raw meat is even between their teeth, basically. And even he shall be for our God and be like a leader in Judah, and Ekron like a Jebusite. There is a little bit of hope here. Basically, what God's saying, some of these Philistines will wake up and they'll even convert to the true and living God. Maybe not a lot, but they'll migrate over and they'll become, they actually become a Philistine remnant that become Jews and incorporate themselves with the Jewish people. How many, we don't know. Probably a very small number, but there would be some. So there's a promise there that even the Philistines would have a remnant. And then, of course, God's promise upon Israel and upon his house in verse number 8. And that brings us to the next section, which is, of course, about the Lord Jesus Christ himself. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He's just and having salvation, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem. The battle bow shall be cut off. He shall speak peace to the nations. His dominion shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. We already read about the rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey. Let's read Matthew 21, 1 through 5.
And when they drew nigh unto Jerusalem, and were come to Bethpage, and unto the Mount of Olives, then sent Jesus two disciples, saying unto them, Go into the village over against you, and straightway you shall find an ass tied, and a colt with her. Loose them, and bring them unto me. And if any man say aught unto you, you shall say, The Lord hath need of them. And straightway he will send them. All this was done, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, Tell ye the daughter of Zion, Behold, a king cometh unto thee, meek, and sitting upon an ass, and a colt the foal of an ass.
Thank you, Ed. Now that's obviously what we would call Palm Sunday nowadays. to the triumphal entry into Jerusalem foretold here in the book of Zechariah. As you look here in Zechariah, in verse 10, Ephraim and Jerusalem are put on the same plane. There's a reason for that. Ephraim actually was no longer part of Israel, part of Judah at this time. It had been taken into captivity. It was becoming a Samaritan land. But the reason they would be put on the same plane is a promise of God to reunite north and south and one united kingdom again. You find that promise many times in the scriptures. Ezekiel does it with the figure of two sticks that are put together to show the reuniting. And when we see that reuniting, we shouldn't just think of the nation of Israel. We should think of the unity of God's people of all time, how God has his people and he puts them together and keeps them together for his own purposes and his own glory. So we really should see a spiritual significance that goes beyond merely a land promise, so to speak. Micah chapter 4, verses 2 through 4.
Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between many people, and render decisions for mighty distant nations. Then they will hammer their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. Each of them will sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken."
Okay. The Old Testament is full of prophecies like this that show the Gentile nations and the Gentiles coming to understand who the real true God of all heaven and earth is. And you even see that here in the end of Zechariah. His dominion shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth, which just means worldwide, everywhere. He will be known as God. That takes place, and we're seeing that take place today. We see that more and more and more. But it won't finally be realized until the new heavens and the new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. And then it'll be a universal 100% truth. There'll be only one God of heaven and earth, and all will worship him. Now, God's the defender of his people, we see in verse 11. "As for you also, because of the blood of your covenant, I will set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Return to the stronghold, you prisoners of hope. Even today I declare that I'll restore double to you, for I've bent Judah, my bow, fitted the bow with Ephraim, and raised up your sons, O Zion." Now, we're going to talk about the bow next week, because it's in chapter 10 also. And so the bow of Judah and the bow of Ephraim will be better served there. What we see first, the blood of the covenant is mentioned here. And that's, of course, the covenant being sealed with blood. Let's read Exodus 24, 5 through 8.
24, 5 through 8. "And he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read it in the audience of the people, and they said, 'All that the Lord hath said we will do, and be obedient.' And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, 'Behold, the blood of the covenant, which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words.'"
Okay. Thank you. There's a lot of places we can go to, but that's what we're talking about, the blood of the covenant. And, of course, the covenant that God had with Israel, and there was blood involved, with blood involved in sacrifices, too. You notice it says prisoners. It says prisoners in a waterless pit, and then it says prisoners of hope. The whole idea here is that even though they are back in the land and they're rebuilding the temple, they're still under Gentile domination. They still haven't achieved total freedom. And it's interesting, but they never did. They actually never did. The closest they came, we'll talk about in just a moment. But even at the time of Christ, they weren't free, were they? They were under Roman domination. But do you remember? It's one of the most ironic things in Scripture. It's in John chapter 8, verse 33, when the crowds and the religious leaders are arguing with Christ himself. They're arguing. And basically, he says, that's where he ends up the saying, "Before Abraham was, I am." They took up stones to stone him. Well, before that, their argument back was, "We're Abraham's descendants." And then they say, and we were never in bondage to any man. A little myopic there. They were in bondage as they said that, you know. And so they just didn't really have a clue of how things were going. But, you know, anyway, they restore double. See restore double there in the text. That probably is an allusion to the fact that the firstborn of the family would get a double portion and a double inheritance. And God's promising abundance to the rest of the remnant that's come back. That they'd have favor like that from him. But verse 13, here's another interesting tidbit. For I bent Judah my bow, fitted the bow with Ephraim, and raised up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and made you like the sword of a mighty man. Now, we just got through talking about how great Alexander the Great was and all the conquests that he did. And we know for a fact that the Jews never fought Alexander the Great and beat him. So it's obviously talking about something else. And it is talking about something else. Here's another prophecy that is being fulfilled, and an interesting one, very much so too. This would take place around the time of the Maccabees. Judas Maccabeus led a revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes about 168 B.C. or so. And you can read about that right here in the church building. If you look in that nice old Bible there, it's got the book of 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees in it. Old Bibles used to have those apocryphal books in them. And actually, 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees, even though they're not biblical books as such, they are historical books that were written during that period of time. And the historical accuracy, while we wouldn't claim them to be inspired, is considered relatively reliable. And that's where we learn a lot about the Maccabees and the revolt period that took place. Antiochus Epiphanes, of course, was a wicked and an evil man beyond all comprehension. He was evil, actually. He either did or attempted to go into the temple of God and offer pigs upon the altar in the Holy of Holies. He apparently did do that, although there's some question by some that he was in his intention and he was stopped. But that's probably Jews that want to, you know, not ever want to think that their temple was profaned as badly as that. You know, so he did that, and he did that as an affront to them. And he himself would have been considered of Greek descent. And, of course, the Maccabees destroyed and threw off that kind of bondage. And actually, the Jews achieved their greatest freedom from the time that they went into captivity at that particular time, during the time of the Maccabees. And we're getting around that time of year again where they celebrate Hanukkah. And that's what Hanukkah is all about. It has to do with the overthrow of Antiochus Epiphanes and the cleansing of the temple. And it's a tradition, a legend, that they relit the candles or relit the oil in the temple. And you had to put oil in that thing every single day. But they couldn't do that because of the war and because of the battle. But God kept it going for all that period of time. It miraculously kept going. Well, whether that's true or not, I couldn't vouch for that. But that's the legend of Hanukkah. That's why you have the candles that are being lit and all of that that takes place. And that is historically accurate as far as the battles that did take place. And so there's the 8-day celebration that they still have to this day. Okay, verses 14 through 17 is where we'll conclude today. And it would be best, I think, to understand these in light of Messiah's second coming. Not in light of his first coming now, but in light of the second coming. And we'll read a couple of scriptures to prove that in just a second. But verse 14, then the Lord will be seen over them, and his arrow will go forth like lightning. The Lord will blow the trumpet and go with whirlwinds from the south. The Lord of hosts will defend them. They'll devour and subdue with sling stones. They shall drink and roar as if with wine. They shall be filled with blood like basins, like the corner of the altar. The Lord their God will save them in that day as the flock of his people, for they shall be like the jewels of a crown, lifted like a banner over his land. For how great is their goodness, and how great their beauty. Grain shall make the young men thrive, and new wine the young women. It's prophetic language, but it's language of God destroying the enemies, and God, of course, blessing his people and blessing them and raising them to a high estate. And the lost will be destroyed. Let's read 2 Peter 3:10.
But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with a fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will all be burned up.
Okay. Okay, that's the very end right there. We read in other places about the trumpet shall blow. We read here about the trumpet. A trumpet is often a call to battle. And so it becomes very appropriate when God's going to wage the final battle that a trumpet would blow and the world end without even a fight, basically, without even so much as a whimper of opposition, because who can stand against the Lord? But his people will be his jewels. They're like jewels in his crown, blessed by him. And that's the way we ought to look at ourselves. Because he loves his people, his favors towards his people. Let's read Malachi 3:17.
They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels, and I will spare them, as a man spares his own son who serves him.
Yeah. We have a hymn in our book. We'll talk about precious jewels, I can't know how it goes exactly, but it's a children's hymn. And when we had a school, we used to teach it to our kids. It's pretty appropriate. It's a great hymn talking about how Christians and the people of God of all the ages are like the jewels of his crown. Not because we're so great and wonderful, but because that's what he's made us to be. Okay. Any comments or questions here? We've got about 5 minutes. We could. Yes, Brendan.
The book of the covenant that would refer to the covenants.
The blood of the covenant is what it says here. Does your version say book of the covenant? Blood of the covenant.
It says blood of the covenant.
Yeah.
Verse 11.
Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, we read Exodus, which talked about the blood covenant that Moses did and sprinkled upon the people. But the Ten Commandments is intricately entwined with all of this. It's worth mentioning right now what we believe as Reformed Baptists about the Ten Commandments. We see the Ten Commandments as God's moral law that was true before Sinai and is still true today. In other words, take each of those Ten Commandments and there's truth in them of what's right and what's wrong. The most controversial commandment is obviously commandment number 4, the Sabbath day. You can say, well, there is no Sabbath day. That's been done away with and that's been abrogated. I don't agree with that. I think there's ceremonial aspects of the Sabbath that's been done away with and abrogated. And that would even include the day of worship, I believe. I don't believe the day is moral. The fact that there's a 1 in 7 principle is moral. We owe God worship. We owe God worship at a particular time. And we can't go months at a time without worshiping God and think that we're doing well. We owe him worship. So the moral principles are true. But the Ten Commandments set in stone become covenantal shorthand for the entire covenant of God for the nation of Israel. So that's what takes place at Sinai, and that's what takes place for the people that God's giving his revelation to. We can see the Ten Commandments. Now, in our vestibule, we have the Ten Commandments posted in shorthand. We've actually just taken all 10 and just put them as a sentence, a piece. But if you read the Ten Commandments, they're actually longer than that, aren't they? In fact, Commandment 2 is like 2 verses long and quite lengthy. But you can shorthand down the Ten Commandments. God, Christ himself shortened down the Ten Commandments in the New Testament to say, love God, love your neighbor. You do that, you fulfill the law. And then you can see how that does fulfill both the two tablets of the law. But there is a technical use of the Ten Commandments that would be seen as shorthand for God's covenant with Israel exclusively. And then you can talk about the 5 books of Moses in that way too. That this is God's covenant with Israel. Or you can talk about the whole Old Testament and say, here's God's covenant with Israel. Everything leading up to Messiah. And of course, at Messiah, things change in the aspect that it's not God's covenant with a nation any longer. It's now God's covenant with his people. And he brings into his nation people of every tongue, tribe, kindred, nation. I think I answered more than you asked, but I wanted a chance to say that. I wanted a chance to get that out because it's not always understood. Okay, anything else? Yes, Ed.
Can you talk about an intertestamental period where Herod the Great came from? Was he appointee of Rome, or did he have a father or grandfather who was on the throne of Judah?
Yeah, he was appointed by Rome, and there was an actual lineage of them. He was an Idumean. And Herod is kind of like a title. Like Caesar's a title, Herod is a title too. You know, so you'll find many Herods in the Bible. It gets very confusing sometimes because it talks about Herod this, Herod that, and you think they're all the same guy, but they're not.